This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. Hi, I'm Lester Graham. Today we talk with the new chair of the Democratic National Committee about why his party lost Michigan.
You know, we simply weren't present in all too many areas of the state.
He's in Michigan right now. We find out why the state of Michigan is about to run out of money to clean up polluted industrial sites.
There always kind of seems like they're scrambling around to figure out where do we have some available funds to deal with the problem that we think is most immediate.
Then, 10 years ago, a film festival was accused of showing pornographic films and its arts grant money was revoked.
There were conversations about, you know, is this going to shut down the Ann Arbor Film Festival because it was that quick and unexpected of a hit.
It ended up being a free speech lawsuit. And that time I was talking to Chuck Berry. But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Most of our GOP congressional delegation has come out against President Trump's proposed gutting of Great Lakes funding. Meanwhile, a Republican-sponsored bill in the State House would prevent Michigan from having stronger regulations than the federal government on things like environmental issues. We'll try to sort that all out in our Friday political roundup. And today, by the way, is National Cocktail Day, so naturally we'll have one to help you celebrate. But first, the new Democratic National Committee Chair Tom Perez and Deputy Chair Keith Ellison are in Michigan. The state is the first stop in what is being called the Democratic Turnaround Tour. Tom Perez joins us now. Welcome to Michigan.
Great to be with you, Lester.
Of course, the Democrats lost Michigan. The state went for Donald Trump. The Hill reports your choice to start here is symbolic because establishment Democrats are accused of ignoring signs that local support was slipping away until it was too late. Is that the case?
Well, we have to do a better job here. We have to do a better job across the state of connecting with voters, not just in Michigan, but across the country. And that's exactly what we're doing in this tour. We're making house calls. We're listening to voters. We want to understand their fears, their hopes, their dreams, and we want to make sure that we put our values into action every day, that they understand that the Democratic Party is fighting for them. We didn't do a good enough job of communicating our mission, our message, and our vision to voters, and that's exactly why we're here, listening and learning and putting our values into action.
Of course, there are some divisions in your party. Bernie Sanders won the Michigan Democratic primary. You're still divided between establishment Democrats and supporters who think Sanders was a better choice than Hillary Clinton. What are you doing to patch up those divisions?
Well, I think we're very united. Look at the debate right now on the Affordable Care Act. There's not one Democrat supporting the repeal of the Affordable Care Act. If you're a Michigander here listening to this show, you know where Democrats stand on that. There's 637,000 Michiganders benefited from Medicaid expansion. There's over 4 million Michiganders with a pre-existing condition. Democrats are united in making sure that people have access to affordable health care, and the Affordable Care Act repeal bill is a boon for the wealthy who would stand to benefit immensely. It's an age tax for people between 50 and 64, and it really is harmful to not only Michigan but to our nation. So you look at unity. That's the definition of unity on the Democratic side.
Well, that's one issue, and you kind of sidestepped the question. What are you doing to heal the divisions between those Bernie Sanders supporters and those who are more establishment or Hillary Clinton supporters?
Well, you know, you look at what we're doing now. Keith Ellison and I are together. Congressman Ellison is not here yet because he's in Washington defending the Affordable Care Act. The vote is going to occur today. It was supposed to occur yesterday. And we've been together since the end of this election, going around the country, talking about how what unites us as Democrats far exceeds our differences. And what unites us are our values. We want to make sure that everyone has access to the American dream. We want to tackle the unfinished business of America right now, which is addressing chronic income inequality. And we're united in that. And I'm very optimistic about the road ahead for Democrats because you're correct. January 20th was an important day as Donald Trump was given the levers of power. But frankly, January 21st was far more important because we saw across America people taking not just to Washington, but millions of people taking to the streets to say, Donald Trump, you do not reflect our values. And what we're doing as Democrats, whether you voted for Bernie Sanders or Hillary Clinton or Jill Stein, we are saying to you, you know what? We share your values, whether it's climate change, whether it's preserving the Affordable Care Act, whether it's raising wages and investing in our people, we share those values. And that is where why we're here in Michigan. That's why we're going across America, to make sure that we put our values into action, that we do a better job of listening, because we have to make house calls. And you can't just make house calls, you know, the October before the election. That has to be a 12-month-a-year enterprise. And that's exactly what we're doing.
You're talking about the day after the inauguration. There has been a number of demonstrations, rallies, marches. It reminds me the beginning of the Tea Party movement. You know, a lot of anger fueled that movement. Now there's a lot of liberals who are angry. Anger, whether you like it or not, pushes people to act, demonstrate, maybe vote. How's the Democratic Party reacting to that?
Well, we're putting this energy into action. And let me give you one example. There was an election in a state senate in Delaware, and the state senate was tied 16-16. This election was going to determine which party controlled the Senate. And what we did, the DNC, working together with our revolution, working together with the Delaware Party and others, came together. That 4 years ago, that election was razor thin. The Republican lost by only 1 or 2 points. This time, the Democrats won by 16 points. So what we're doing is we're channeling our energy into action, channeling it into results. What we have to do as a Democratic Party is make sure that we are building strong state parties everywhere, making sure that we understand that our mission is to elect Democrats from the school board to the Senate and everywhere in between, not just working toward the presidency. And when we build strong parties and when we lead with our values and put our values into action, and when we channel this energy that's out there into electoral action, that's how we prevail. That's why I have a lot of optimism about the upcoming elections in Virginia and New Jersey. There's also a lot of municipal elections, not only in Michigan, but across the country. And we're investing in those because that's the new Democratic Party, working together, putting our values into action. And I'm very excited about the energy that we've been able to channel, whether it's helping elect that state senator or helping elect people elsewhere that we are working for. That's what we have to do, is channel the energy into concrete action and concrete election results.
In Michigan, Republicans hold the governor's office, all the constitutional officers' positions. They control both chambers of the legislature. They hold 9 of the 14 congressional seats. And as we mentioned earlier, the state went red in this most recent election. What's your plan in Michigan?
Well, we're going to work together to make sure that we have an every zip code strategy. We have to be present everywhere, whether it's in Marquette, Michigan, or Wayne County, or Macomb County. We can't cede any zip code. Again, it's important to recognize that we lost by, I believe, 13,000 votes in the presidential cycle. And in part, that reflected the fact that we simply weren't present in all too many areas of the state. And that's the story in Wisconsin, and that's the story in all too many other places. And that is why our 57-state strategy, that's the 50 states plus the territories, it doesn't simply involve spending time in certain parts of the state. It involves communicating with everyone. That's why I've been to rural Wisconsin already. That's why I will be in 3 different parts of Michigan today, because we are here to send a message to every person in every zip code that the Democratic Party is here to fight for you, fight for your ability to punch your ticket to the middle class, to make sure you have access to health care, access to retirement security, that your children will get that good education that they so deserve and will enable them to punch their ticket to the middle class. We're taking that message into every zip code. And when we do that, Democrats succeed.
As you've noted, conventional wisdom says the Democratic Party ignored the Midwest, but it also says you ignored the middle class, you ignored the white working class. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think our message of job creation, the message of work, looking out for every voter in every zip code. Dr. King said that, the best civil right is a good job. And you know what? That's true regardless of what zip code you live in. And the Democratic Party has been fighting for job creation. And if you want to create jobs, put a Democrat in the White House. Remember, George Herbert Walker Bush handed Bill Clinton a recession. Bill Clinton handed George W. Bush 4% unemployment, surpluses as long as the eye could see. George W. Bush handed Barack Obama carnage, the worst recession of our lifetime, unemployment up to 10%. Barack Obama bailed out the auto industry here in Michigan and across America, saving over 1 million jobs. and the unemployment rate was down to 4.8%. There's still work to do, and we need to do a better job as Democrats of communicating our values, communicating what we've done to fight for people, and making sure we're doing that everywhere. And when we do that, I believe that we can succeed. And the energy that's out there right now is absolutely palpable. And I see it in every corner of Michigan, and I see it in every corner of America, where it's not just people who've always been active, but folks who have been, frankly, casual participants in democracy. And they tell me, you know, Tom, I now appreciate that democracy is not a spectator sport. I can't just go once in a while. I've got to be there all the time, because they see that Donald Trump does not stand for their values. They look at what's happening in Washington with 24 million people whose health insurance is in jeopardy. They see all the Goldman Sachs partners who are running this White House. That's not the change that people voted for. That's simply more of a bigger swamp of alligators.
Voter turnout among Democrats was low in 2016, and Democrats aren't really known for their big turnouts during midterm elections. What kind of strategy can you use to change that?
We're getting out there now. We're not waiting until the fall of 2016. And we're organizing, organizing, organizing. And we're partnering with many groups. There's just a remarkable number of organic groups that are out there now, Indivisibles, Swing Left, other groups. And many of their members may not be registered Democrats. But what I've seen in my participation at various rallies across this country is that they share our values. And so what we're doing as Democrats is making sure that we are a conspicuous presence, a conspicuous partner with them in these efforts, so that they see that, you know what, the Democratic Party shares my values. When we do that, and when we do it 12 months a year, not just 2 months before a midterm or 2 months before a presidential, that's how we move people. I met all too many people who said that the Democratic Party hadn't come to see them. The Democratic Party hadn't asked for their vote. The Democratic Party hadn't been in their community. And that's on us. And that's why we're out here.
Tom Perez is the new chair of the Democratic National Committee. He's making stops in Detroit and Flint. Thanks for taking a moment to talk with us.
Thank you. Good to talk to you and your listeners.
Up next, our Friday Political Roundup panel addresses Michigan's stewardship of the Great Lakes. Then, we revisit a story I did with legendary rock and roll artist Chuck Berry. And it's National Cocktail Day. We'll mix up an old-fashioned in its honor. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. President Donald Trump's proposed budget shifts spending from domestic areas to security areas. One of the programs that would be cut under the proposal is the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. That money has been used to clean up polluted areas that they call Great Lakes Areas of Concern, preventing and controlling invasive species, reducing nutrient runoff that contributes to harmful blooms of algae. That's what led to Toledo's water system being shut down, and restoring habitat to protected native species. Here to talk about that are Vicki Barnett, a former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic legislator, and Ken Sikkema, senior policy fellow with Public Sector Consultants and the former Republican majority leader in the state Senate. He joins us by Skype. Vicki, this $300 million to protect the Great Lakes is especially important to Michigan. A lot of the efforts to protect the lakes are based here. What's the administration's reasoning behind eliminating this funding?
I can't speak for the president. I haven't talked to him personally, but it seems like his agenda is to go back to simply basics, gut everything that's an extra program not mentioned in the Constitution, and to proceed from there. So he wants to shift more money to the military and gut all of these other programs that are so important for protecting the health, safety, and welfare of our residents. The Great Lakes watershed and the Great Lakes themselves are home to 20% of the world's fresh water supply. And we have a special obligation and duty to make sure that we protect this great worldwide resource.
Ken, protecting the Great Lakes has always been a bipartisan effort among the congressional delegations in the eight Great Lakes states. How do you think members of Congress will react to this budget proposal?
I think it's going to, that part of it will be rejected. You know, the problem with the Trump administration is they want to increase military spending by about $54 billion, but they want to leave Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and those entitlement programs off the table. So you don't really have much elsewhere to go and get that money. But as you point out, the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative has been bipartisan, and I don't think that kind of cut's going to survive the legislative meat grinder. I do think Congress needs to kind of scrub that program a little bit, because it's been a little bit of a catch-all. There's what I would call necessary and essential projects in it, like protecting drinking water, cleaning up environmental pollution. But then there are some other what I would call kind of good and helpful projects, like pier and fish habitat and artificial reefs, that probably aren't as important as others. But generally speaking, I think that restoration initiative is going to survive.
In Lansing, the House Oversight Committee has approved a bill which would forbid Michigan from passing any rules stricter than a federal standard unless the state can demonstrate there are exceptional circumstances that justify it. In the past, legislators of both parties have felt that since we're surrounded by the Great Lakes, Michigan has a greater responsibility to at least protect the environment. Vicki, what's changed?
Nothing's changed. In fact, this bill is a rehash of other similar bills, one in particular that the governor vetoed when I was in the legislature in 2011. And the language in this bill is very specific. Unless there is a clear and convincing need, and only if the federal government has required the state to set up requirements and rules, can the state then proceed with rules stricter than the federal government. This is very dangerous language, and it would eliminate our ability to really set up higher standards for ballast water and protecting the Great Lakes from invasive species. In addition, Michigan is one of the states in the Great Lakes that is part of the Great Lakes Compact with two provinces in Canada, Ontario and Quebec. And the Canadian government also participates in the funding programs for Great Lakes protection. And the Canadians are very concerned already about the move to start to defund some of these programs, which leave them as exposed to invasive species and destruction of a great habitat for them as it does for us.
Ken, given the current administrator of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, it's likely environmental protection rules will be relaxed in many areas. What do you think of Michigan simply following the federal government lead in this area?
Well, the Republicans at the state level are kind of, from an intellectual and policy perspective, arguing themselves into a pretzel here. They, historically, Republicans have been champions of states' rights, basically saying that the federal government is not the be-all and end-all of policy, and the states ought to have more authority. They're the laboratories of democracy, even when it comes to federal programs like Medicaid or welfare. And now all of a sudden, the federal government does seem to be the be-all and end-all of policy. So it's just, it's not a consistent argument. And like I said, it's, I would call it kind of an intellectual and policy pretzel they're creating.
That's Ken Sikkema. He's Senior Policy Fellow at Public Sector Consultants and a former Republican legislative leader. Vicki Barnett is a former mayor of Farmington Hills and served as a Democratic legislator. Thanks. Appreciate the time.
Thanks, Lester and Ken. It's been a good discussion.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. I was sad to hear about Chuck Berry's death last weekend. When I worked in St. Louis a couple of decades ago, getting an interview with Berry was a challenge. Every reporter in town was trying to get one. He hadn't given an interview in more than 2 years when I decided to give it a shot. The owner of a venue where Berry played every couple of months suggested I come to the 40th anniversary of Chuck Berry's Johnny B. Goode. The idea was the club owner would help me get an interview before the show. I showed up. That did not happen. So I relaxed, had a couple of beers, recorded some of the concert with terrible acoustics. I started talking to the guy next to me. He was a public radio fan, really interested in a series of reports I'd done in St. Louis on schools desegregation. And when I asked his name, he replied, Charles Berry Jr. Yeah, Chuck's son. So I told him why I was there, and he made sure I got an interview after the show. Here's the piece I produced back in 1998.
Chuck Berry had already recorded such classic rock and roll hits as Maybelline, Roll Over Beethoven, and Rock and Roll Music, but the summer of 58 saw Berry's signature song, Johnny B. Goode, climb to the top 10 of Billboard's Top 100 list.
Deep down in Louisiana, across to New Orleans, way back up in the woods among the evergreens.
Just a few years before, Chuck Berry had been working a day job and at night playing blues and a unique style of hillbilly guitar music in an East St. Louis club. Occasionally, Berry would finish early and go to another club to sit in with the Sir John Trio. The trio's leader and piano player, Johnny Johnson, says eventually he and Berry got together.
One night, one of my musicians got sick and couldn't make it. And during that time, Chuck wasn't working that night, so I called him and asked him would he fill in for me that one night. And he agreed to do so, and that one night lasted around 30 years.
Berry became a member of the Sir John Trio, but he was restless. Berry wanted more than just playing the clubs. In Chicago, he ran into blues man Muddy Waters, who was an artist with Chess Records, and asked him how to get a record cut. Muddy Waters was impressed enough with Berry, he introduced him to Chess Records owner Leonard Chess. Chuck Berry played some blues tunes for Chess, but sales of blues records were on the decline, so it was a rollicking mix of hillbilly music and rhythm and blues that caught Leonard Chess's attention. The song title Ida Red was changed to Maybelline.
Maybelline, why can't you be true? Oh, Maybelline, why can't you be true? You done started doing the things you used to do.
Johnny Johnson and some Chess recording artists, such as Willie Dixon, helped Berry cut the record. It was a hit with both the black R&B audience and the white pop music fans. The record was issued as Chuck Berry and His Combo. Johnny Johnson says the change from the Sir John Trio to Chuck Berry's Combo never really bothered him.
It was his song. It was his doing that took the tape to Chicago. And so I figured it wasn't no more than right for him to have a title because he did all the work to get us started.
Berry, Johnson, and drummer Ebbie Hardy hit the road in Berry's Cadillac, touring and playing clubs across the nation. By 1961, Chuck Berry was an established rock and roll star. In the next few years, his influence was magnified by the British invasion.
Just let me hear some of that rock and roll music, any old way you choose it.
The chief curator of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame Museum in Cleveland, Jim Henke, says when the British bands such as the Beatles started covering his songs, Chuck Berry's music found a whole new audience.
Certainly, you know, the Stones were greatly influenced by him and the Beatles and all those British groups from the 60s, you know, even recorded a lot of Chuck Berry songs. So I think it's, you know, just that sort of basic rock and roll style that he developed has carried on for 40 years now.
Ironically, when his music was reaching new levels of popularity, Chuck Berry was in jail.
It seems like every 10 years Chuck Berry gets in trouble with the law one way or another.
Ken Thomas is the archivist of research papers on Chuck Berry at the University of Missouri-St. Louis. Thomas says Berry's rock and roll lifestyle landed him in trouble a few times in his life, but in the early 60s, he was serving time for transporting an underage girl over state lines for, quote, immoral purposes.
This is a famous thing in rock and roll history. He was convicted on that and was serving time when the Beatles came out and made a tremendous amount of money off of many of his own songs while he was in prison, not able to go out and tour and not able to take advantage of that success.
Beyond the British invasion, Chuck Berry's influences have been heard in other artists' tunes for years. His driving rhythm, his aggressive guitar riffs, his Girls and Cars lyrical themes all have been repeated in rock songs for decades now. In fact, the Beach Boys went too far in imitating the Chuck Berry sound.
If everybody had an ocean across the USA.
The Beach Boys song Surfin' USA sounded a little too much like Berry's Sweet Little 16.
They're really rocking in Boston and Pittsburgh, PA.
Berry sued the Beach Boys and won songwriting credit for Surfin' USA in court. His influences on rock and roll had been so great, when it was established in 1986, Chuck Berry was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Again, chief curator Jim Henke.
He was actually the very first person to be inducted into the Hall of Fame, and I think it was clearly just because of the influence that he had had in the development of the music. I mean, he really is one of the two or three most influential people. I mean, right there at the top of the list. And so it was, you know, I guess pretty natural that Chuck would be one of the first to get in.
During the 1980s and now in the 90s, Berry is still performing.
Oh, I don't tour anymore. I just play like once a week, a couple times a month, you know, because they tell me they can't afford me, you know.
Berry can still fill concert halls of 10,000, but in St. Louis, he can often be found playing in a small hall called the Duck Room, named in honor of Berry's move on stage, the Duck Walk, at a place called Blueberry Hill. Blueberry Hill owner Joe Edwards has become a friend of Berry's, and the rock and roll legend plays the Duck Room every couple of months.
You know, I'm just thrilled that he plays at Blueberry Hill, because when he's out of town, he's playing in huge places in Europe and in Las Vegas and Atlanta and different places around the country. The Duck Room at Blueberry Hill is fairly small, so he does it out of love of music and of St. Louis.
At 72 years of age, Chuck Berry still duck walks right across the stage. He drops to his knees in front of the crowd pressing the stage and gets lost in a guitar solo. When he hops back up, he smiles and asks the crowd to remind him which song he's playing. He checks with a backup musician and launches into the lyrics again. Some wonder if the forgetfulness means the years are catching up with Chuck Berry. But his old piano sideman, Johnny Johnson, smiles at that.
He's too smart a person to forget his song, especially every show he do, he puts on this little act, so I think it's just part of his show. And it gets the laugh out of the crowd, and that's what he's out there for, to entertain the crowd.
The 40th anniversary of Johnny B. Goode has been noted at this show, and Berry cuts loose.
I'm done, Johnny B. Goode.
He says over the years, the song has come to mean different things to him.
When I first wrote it, it was sentimentality, memories, and now it's like money. People buy the song, and you know what? It makes me feel good because it helps me to eat, sleep, take care of my children, you know, and all like that. So it's a living, you know.
Rock and Roll Hall of Fame chief curator Jim Hinkey says regardless what Berry thinks of his creation today, Johnny B. Goode is part of rock and roll history.
Boy, I mean, it's the kind of song that really does define rock and roll. I mean, I think there's maybe a handful of tunes like that, but, you know, Johnny B. Goode is just one of those signature songs that, everyone knows it, and like I said, everyone's probably played it at one point or another in their career.
Chuck Berry is not yet ready to give up playing his hits from the 50s, 60s, and even the 70s. His only number one hit, My Ding-a-Ling, topped the charts in 1972. But he laughs about how long he's been playing rock and roll.
I've been in it, since 55. What's that, 44 years? 33 years? 4, 5, 6 years, whatever. But anyway, I feel good. I ain't lying. I feel good. In fact, I'm glad to be anywhere now, you know.
Chuck Berry says he's been negotiating with record companies for a new album. He's got 9 new songs he wants to record, but he says the big labels want too much of a cut. He's now considering recording on a local label in the hope of keeping a bigger percentage of the take for himself. But he's in no hurry. At this point in his career, Chuck Berry's got nothing more to prove. This is Lester Graham.
That was the story I did with Chuck Berry and others 19 years ago. Berry died on March 18th at the age of 90. To a lot of rock and roll fans, a life to be celebrated.
Cheers.
Cheers. Cheers.
Hi, Tammy.
Hi, Lester.
That's Tammy Coxon with Tammy's Tastings, and we're mixing up a cocktail today. What do you have for us?
Well, it's National Cocktail Day, so we're going to make a cocktail. I don't know who comes up with these days, but I'm kind of glad to have an occasion to celebrate.
Not exactly a Hallmark moment, but, you know, drinks. Cheers.
Cheers.
Okay, well, what is your cocktail?
So we're making a cocktail. These days, we call any mixed drink a cocktail, but historically, different kinds of drinks had different names. We've heard of flips and slings and sours. And so a cocktail was a very specific recipe, and it meant that it was a drink that had spirits, sugar, bitters, and water from ice. And it was the bitters specifically that made it a cocktail as opposed to some other kind of drink. So I took 2 ounces of the Grass Widow Bourbon from Two James Distillery in Detroit, and I combined that with 1/4 ounce of a Demerara simple syrup, which is just simple syrup made with a sugar in the raw. And then I had 2 dashes of Angostura bitters, stirred that up, served it in a rocks glass with an orange twist, and also some of the brandied cherries I put up last summer, pierced on a Zitatini pick, which is from somebody right here in Ann Arbor.
Zitatini.
That's right, yep. She makes martini picks and other fun stuff. And it's a nice, pretty way to garnish the drink.
Does this cocktail have a name?
This is what we today would call an old-fashioned cocktail because it's a cocktail made in that old-fashioned style.
Oh, to differentiate between the new cocktails that were coming up, you just say, give me an old-fashioned cocktail or just an old-fashioned.
That's right. Once cocktails started being the generic term for a mixed drink, then you had to specify, I want a cocktail made in the old-fashioned way.
So Angostura bitters, probably the most commonly sold bitters. Why did you choose those for this drink?
Well, I chose them because there aren't any Michigan bitters yet. Michigan makes a lot of really interesting spirits, but nobody so far has been making bitters. But when I was searching the internet trying to find some for this drink, I did find that there's a Kickstarter going on for a company called Black Ink Bitters, and they're trying to launch a line of Michigan bitters. So I'm looking forward to adding those to our cocktail repertoire.
Sometime in the future, I suppose. Well, thanks for making this for us.
Cheers.
Coming up, pornography or art? We'll look back at the legacy of a free speech lawsuit that came out of the Ann Arbor Film Festival a decade ago. That's in 10 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Each year, the state of Michigan spends about $15 million to clean up abandoned industrial sites. Contamination can threaten water sources and public health. The state is about to run out of money to do that cleanup. James Clift is the policy director for the Michigan Environmental Council. I got to tell you, I can't tell you how many people I've met over the years who think we took care of all these pollution problems back in the 1970s. How many polluted sites are there in the state?
Altogether, we have about 15,000 sites. About 7,000 of them are old leaking underground storage tanks, and about 8,000 are kind of other contaminated sites.
So what has the state of Michigan done over the last few decades to clean them up?
It addresses the worst sites. They always find sites that these are threatening public health today. Let's go in and address this site. Or it's threatening a community water supply, so they'll kind of rush in and spend a lot of money on that site. But they really haven't put a big dent in the backlog of sites. About 3-4 years ago, they started saying, okay, let's try to get rid of this backlog. We'll go back and relook at them because they've known about them for 10, 20 years or more. And what they find when they went back and started relooking at them, about 250 sites a year, about 10% of them, threat to public health, need to do something immediately. 30, 40% of them need more work, not immediately, but it does need more work. And about half of them, they've realized that the contamination is such where it's not threatening public health.
Why is it? How is it that the state is running out of money to do these cleanups?
So you go back all the way to maybe 2000, and we used to use a fair amount of general fund money for this purpose, actually up to $20 million a year we were using.
That's the big checking account for the state, right? General fund.
Yeah, that is. That's general fund. That's all we have, all the tax dollars that come in. More recently, they've been using mainly bond money, environmental bonds that were approved by the voters. And that's what they've been using to run the remediation division. But now we're almost out of that bond money. There's one other little account they have. It's called the Refined Petroleum Fund. It's generated by a 1 cent fee on gasoline sales in the state, 1 cent per gallon. That generates about $50 million a year. And that's used to address both some of the publicly held sites or the publicly responsible sites, we call them orphan sites, and some of the private sites out there.
So we're cleaning up polluted sites with borrowed money. Why?
Well, because when we went into kind of the recession in 2008 and our checking account, our big account, general fund, started getting very tight, you know, that's when we started getting away from using general fund and using these bond monies instead. Now, of course, our economy's coming back. There is more general fund, even to the point where they were going to put some in what they call the rainy day fund. But again, I think we've just got used to using bond money and not general fund.
Yeah, well, there are a lot of claims on that rainy day fund money, too. I understand that Governor Rick Snyder has a proposal to fix this problem for a year. What's he suggesting?
Yeah, so it's that refined petroleum fund that I mentioned. This is, again, a 1 cent fee on each gallon of gasoline sold. Generates about $50 million. They've got a little extra money in that account. So they're saying, hey, let's use $15 million out of that account this year. I am guessing that they're going to have the same problem next year. And then longer term, they're discussing whether or not a new bond should be floated.
Well, let me stop you for a second, because you're talking about stealing from Peter to pay Paul. What kind of problems do these leaking underground gasoline storage tanks cause? I mean, don't we need the money to clean them up?
Yeah, the same problem we're seeing at the other sites, you know, where we've got some of these sites where the contamination has gotten into groundwater It threatens people's individual drinking water wells, sometimes community wells. A new thing we're hearing about is vapor intrusion, where it will come into contact with a foundation of a building. Then the vapors will seep into the basement of that building. We've had to evacuate some buildings in recent years. So not addressing these sites have consequences, and we're starting to feel those.
So why would the governor want to take money from cleaning up those storage tanks to use it to clean up and abandon industrial sites? Now we're doing half measures for two major problems.
Yeah, unfortunately, you'll see a lot of this in state budgeting in general and a lot of it within the Department of Environmental Quality budget, where there always kind of seems like they're scrambling around to figure out where do we have some available funds to deal with the problem that we think is most immediate.
So even if this one-time shift in money is approved, you said it might be done again the next year. I mean, is there no long-term fix being talked about in Lansing?
Again, a little bit of talking about bonding, but again, that wouldn't happen until at least the 2018.
It's still borrowed
the first
money,
election.
I mean,
still borrowed money.
It costs us more that way.
Yeah, it does. It costs us at least 1.5 times that amount. So if you look around the country, you know, we've kind of liked the Minnesota model. A few years back, what they did is they dedicated a quarter of 1% of the sales tax to dealing with their environmental issues. It actually funds their whole environmental agency. But that is kind of one of the other models out there that Michigan could look at.
Well, that's the mood of the legislature in Michigan is not of the one in Minnesota. I mean, they were talking about tax cuts earlier this year. How are we ever going to convince the legislature that we need to increase taxes to clean up pollution?
Again, this is always something that would have to go to the voters. So I think that would be one is, you know, should we consider putting that to the voters, or do we put a bond and that up and decide is it a combination of those two that move forward? The bonding idea, of course, is now wrapped up into the infrastructure bond that the Infrastructure Commission suggested. So, again, lots of needs out there trying to figure out which ones to deal with.
Right. That's James Clift. He's the policy director for the Michigan Environmental Council. Thanks for explaining this to us.
Thank you.
This year marks the 10-year anniversary of a legal case that challenged free speech and expression. The Ann Arbor Film Festival was accused of showing pornographic films at its event. The Michigan legislature withdrew funds that were to be awarded by the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. The Ann Arbor Film Festival, with the aid of the ACLU and the National Coalition Against Censorship, sued in federal court. Kristen Leon lived that experience. In 2007, she was the director of the Ann Arbor Film Festival, and she joins us now. Let's start with the obvious question. What were you showing at the film festival that the legislators thought was pornographic?
Sure. There were 24 films named in this case that were called pornographic, and some of them were a bit provocative, I will say, but some of them were not at all. One was an Academy Award nominated or winning film animation called Booby Girl that was made for teenagers. That was like a lesson of, you know, careful what you wish for. One film that was called pornographic was, you know, excuse my language for a second, but it's not what it sounds like. The film was called America's Biggest Dick, and it was a satire on Dick Cheney in a political film, and they called that pornographic.
Yeah, context is important.
Yes, exactly. And it was very clear to us when the films were named that they were not watched. The legislators went by titles and synopses, and from that point, you know, had an agenda and called them pornographic. But when I started looking at the actual films listed, and I'd had to watch a lot of them because these were all films previous from when I was director, and I watched them and we were thinking, okay, this is clearly something else. What's really going on here?
So where did the legislators get the idea that the Ann Arbor Film Festival was showing pornographic films? I mean, where'd that come from?
Where did it come from? Right. It was a report by the Mackinac Center for Public Policy, and they had an essay written about not calling them pornography, but saying it was an essay more about should the arts be public funded. And they were trying to make a case that the arts should not be public funded. And their reasons were these films. Like saying, you know, is this the kind of content that we want our government to support? And then it was kind of a cue for the legislators. One of them were trying to get elected. They actually weren't in the Senate yet. That essay was the kind of seed that planted their idea. And just by reading about these films and some of them, you know, in their provocative nature, used the word pornography and you know, sent out a press release saying, we're not going to stand for this. We're not going to let the state fund pornography.
I want to clear something up. You're not saying that the Mackinac Center didn't call it pornography, but the legislators jumped to that.
That's right. Okay. That's right.
All right. So how did you find out the grant money was being withheld?
Well, immediately I got a call from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs the day the press release went out saying, heads up, we have an issue here and we've never seen anything like this before. I don't know how, you know, to what scale this is going to go, but this is happening. And all of a sudden it escalated within, you know, very quickly that the MCACA was under fire, and then they revoked funding, not only past funding, but the grant that we were scheduled to receive that year. So it was like multiple years of funding that were just suddenly revoked from a budget that was pretty tight, you know, and it happened just months before our film festival was underway. So it was a bit of a dilemma in terms of stabilizing the organization and making the next film festival happen.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, how did you and the organizers at the film festival manage to keep it going?
Yeah, it was touch and go for a minute. There were even conversations, I have to say, before we reached out to the ACLU and it became this whole, you know, campaign and First Amendment issue, there were conversations about, you know, is this going to shut down the Ann Arbor Film Festival? Because it was that quick and unexpected of a hit. And we had to, you know, raise money and just respond as fast as possible while still planning the festival to respond. And we did stay afloat, and there were individuals, you know, in terms of the like immediate that were there to help us keep the doors open. But we ended up creating a pretty organized campaign, and it was fun too. It was called the Endangered Campaign because all of a sudden the Ann Arbor Film Festival was an endangered species, as we were saying. And we raised $80,000 in 3 months from the local community, which was incredible. Like the community really got together and galvanized and helped stabilize the festival. It was beautiful.
What was the basic argument in the lawsuit?
So the lawsuit, we didn't sue for the money, and we could have, but we didn't want to make it about that. The reason that the legislators were able to even revoke the money and have the power to do that were because of these guidelines that used to be in the application for anybody who wanted funding from the MCACA. And those guidelines were unconstitutional, and that's what the lawsuit was about. So it used to be that if you applied for arts funding, you could not have they had three guidelines for content. You couldn't show human feces on religious symbols. You could not show a desecration of the American flag and no sexual acts of any kind. And those three guidelines violate the First Amendment. The state cannot tell you what you can and can't do in regards to funding and money and everything. So that's where the ACLU came in. I met with the National Coalition Against Censorship, and they introduced me to the ACLU of Michigan. And that was the explanation, is the only reason that this could happen were these guidelines, and these guidelines are unconstitutional. And what was nice was that there was precedence on both state levels and national levels that of other, you know, state governments trying to censor content and control what sort of content receives support. And those, when challenged, they were removed. So that was, you know, a good sign for our lawsuit that it would be successful.
So how was the lawsuit finally settled?
It was settled in about a year and a half after we filed suit out of court. You know, we created quite a campaign for that year and a half, and it became international news, and we had incredible support from the press, celebrities, like all kinds of people getting our back. And finally, one day, the state decided to remove the guidelines altogether. And it was very quick. It was very quiet. You know, I just got a phone call one day saying, okay, we won. They don't want this to go to court. This is actually, you know, a year and a half for this kind of lawsuit's pretty fast. And, you know, you did a good job bringing attention to the situation. And just very quietly, the next year, the guidelines were gone.
How did that experience of fighting for free speech, how'd that affect your life?
It affected it in a big way because I would say before it fell on my lap, you know, I was a new director when this came into play. I had only had the job for about 4 months. And before that, I wasn't much of a political person. You know, like I cared, but my work was more in terms of the entertainment industry and the arts. And it affected my life deeply because I realized, planting the seed of like what one person can do, you know, when you organize a community. And then when you look at the entire community of Ann Arbor and beyond, and how much of a ripple effect we made, it really was, you know, inspiring to me to see when you organize, when you do your diligence, when you partner with organizations like ACLU, National Coalition Against Censorship, when you have a clear message and a clear vision of who you are, whether it was me as an individual or who the Ann Arbor Film Festival is in terms of the identity that the festival holds so strongly to, it was very inspiring, and it was challenging in that it required a lot of time and energy, not just for me. I mean, I was giving my life over 7 days a week, 24 hours a day to this, not only dealing with the lawsuit, but making sure the festival was going to be on healthy ground even after my tenure. But it was really incredible to see a community rise. You know, we felt like it was a bit of a David and Goliath situation. When you're dealing with like government censorship, it's big and it's overwhelming. And it was very, you know, there were attempts to intimidate me, like individuals calling me saying, don't get into involved. Like, you're in over your head. You're too young to deal with this. Like, walk away. And to fight back and stand and say, no, this is the man coming in. And this is a really respected film festival, all, not just locally, all around the world. And you have to stand and take leadership, whether as an individual or a community, you have to take leadership when this happens and realize that you do have power. And with some organizing and good communication, you can fight back.
I see that you're talking about that lawsuit, censorship and free speech in general, along with filmmaker and author Dream Hampton tomorrow at the University of Michigan. What should people expect to hear from you two?
Yeah, not only is it me and Dream, it's also Mike Steinberg, the legal director of the ACLU of Michigan, who will be joining us. And I'd say, like, the first part of it, we're going to talk about this lawsuit and unpack what happened. You know, I'm going to explain some of the grassroots organizing that we did. There were some really good lessons there in terms of strategy and tactics and how to fight back on censorship and intimidation and these kinds of things. And Mike Steinberg is going to, from ACLU, he'll be talking about the legal process that we had to go through. And we brought in Dream Hampton because she's a very well-known activist and storyteller and writer, and brings a very global contemporary perspective to this whole case. And so it's not just about the past. We want to talk about the present and learn more about what the ACLU is dealing with on a local and national level, you know, in terms of all aspects of the First Amendment, not just arts censorship, but all aspects of the First Amendment and where it's at in this day and age, and talk about how this lawsuit and this story and some of our tactics is really relevant to some of the issues happening today.
That event, Ann Arbor Film Festival versus the State of Michigan 10 years later, is being held at the North Quad Space 2435, and it will be held at 11:30 on Saturday. Kristen Lien, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me. I'd be interested in the event, too. Thank you.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mike Blank and engineered by Rusty Brock, who can't get enough of coffee rub spatchcock chicken. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Allie Billings, Lindsay Scullin, Cass Adair, Josh Hakala, Lise Mesmer, Nick Wallace, and Mercedes Mejia. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.